Bob Hickey, grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Sir.
Okay. My sobriety date is June 18th, 1985, and I don't say that to impress anybody, but it always awes me that I've been able to stay sober. If I make it to this June, it'll be 38 years, and that's more than I drank. That's over half my lifetime. I have a home group, and they know I'm a member there. And I have a sponsor, and he knows I'm a sponsor. He's my sponsor. I should probably call him more often, but we've got down kind of like to a little routine. If he don't bother me, I don't bother him. So I'm just kidding with that. I really don't know where I'm going to start tonight. I used to have in my mind a set thing, and in the last 10 years or so, that's changed. I just try and show up and let God tell me what to say. So hopefully that'll be what it is. I just want to say this about David that spoke last week. I probably knew all the places he was talking about because I've been to most of them. And that Nip House that he was talking about was a very scary place. Because they only took the really low bottom drugs. But anyway, I come from an alcoholic family. I'm originally from Charlestown, Mass, which is a mile long and a half a mile wide or so. And it has more bank robbers in there than any other area in the United States. And I don't know if that's something to be proud of or not. My father was an unorganized crime. That's the Irish. The Italians are the ones that are organized, and he stepped on somebody's toes, and we had to leave. Well, he had to leave Boston, and we came down here about 3 months later. Excuse me. My grandfather was an alcoholic. I think an alcoholic. He was a glazer. In the old days, before they had these big sheets in there, they put the single panes in there, and he was the guy to put the glazing in there. And they said he was the best glazer in the city when he was sober. Unfortunately, he wasn't sober very much, and he died in 62 of cancer, but I'm sure alcoholism had a lot to do with it. Like I said, I think my father was an alcoholic because once he started drinking, he couldn't stop. And the only time he quit drinking was when he was on this medicine that was so powerful, he couldn't deal with the side effects, and that stopped him from drinking. Unfortunately, I don't have that excuse. Like I said, I grew up in an alcoholic home. I had four sisters. One of them's in AA. One of them went to Al-Anon for a while, but she doesn't go to anything now. The other one went to AA for a few years, and she's been sober about 35 years. She just doesn't attend meetings. It seems to work for her, but I can't do it that way. And my youngest sister passed away on June 1st, 1986. I always get emotional when I talk about her. I started drinking at a young age. We would, you know, my parents would give me a sip. When I was teething, they used to put whiskey on their fingers and rub it on my gums so the teething wouldn't bite, and I'd be going to sleep sooner than I planned. But my first drinking I was just taking stuff for my parents. My mother always kept a bottle underneath the kitchen sink, and my dad always kept beer either in the fridge or close to it, and I would occasionally borrow them. And that's how I got started. I consider my alcohol started. Me and my buddy, we're in Willoughby, and it's a long peninsula, and it's about 3 miles or so. And me and my buddy were hitchhiking up to Ocean View to find somebody to buy us some beer. And this guy picked us up, and he had a brown paper bag with the neck all wrapped up. And I looked at my buddy, and he looked at me, and we both smiled because we knew he was drinking. And we had found our guy. And so we asked him, he said, sure. So he went into this bar that used to be up in Ocean View, and he got us a six pack of beer, and he was in a bag, he gave it to us. We went down the beach to find a spot to drink it, and then we looked down, and this was before the pop tops. We had a six pack of beer and no way to get in it. So we walked all the way back that 3 miles down to my parents' house, and I went in, I got a can opener, and we went back up a little ways, and we broke into an apartment, an empty apartment building, and they were rehabbing it. And so we started drinking, and the time since we started, I drank 4 beers and he drank 2. And that's how my drinking went for the rest of my drinking time. I never went out to have a drink or a cocktail or a social hour, you know. I went out to get loaded, because why drink one? That doesn't do anything. And I drank. By 15, I was a blackout drinker. Me and my buddies, we drank Friday and Saturday night. Then we started drinking some earlier in the day on Saturdays and some days on Sundays, you know. And if I would have known that was going to be my progression for many years, it was 1969, and for those of you who probably don't remember, they had this little shindig going on over in Southeast Asia, and they were drafting 50,000 men a month. And I knew that I was going to be on the short list, so I went down and I volunteered. And I got in the Air Force, which was very unusual because I was a high school dropout, and they weren't taking dropouts. The Marines and the Navy and the Army might be taking dropouts, but they wanted the guy that I went down there with. He was high scoring in electronics. So they took us both. And I went to boot camp. That was the first time in my life that I'd ever gone that long that I could remember. I went 8 weeks seven weeks without a drink. They let us out to go downtown on the last Saturday of the basic training. They gave us a list of places not to go. And you know how that is. That's the places I went to. And I knew they had the name and the address, you know. And when I got to my next duty station in Keesler, Mississippi for tech school, it was like, you know, fun. And I got graduated from tech school. I got orders to Japan, and I thought, well, you know, that'll be interesting. And when I got to Japan, I found out that it was alcoholic heaven. You could get a case of beer for about $2.40. And liquor was just as cheap. And so we started drinking. And I was an air traffic controller, and I wasn't supposed to drink 8 hours before my shift, but sometimes I didn't quite make that 8 hours. I can remember a couple of times having to go in at 7:30 and getting back to the barracks at about 5 or 5:30, and showering and getting to work, you know. And one guy that I was working with, my boss, he was 25, I was 19, and he said, you know, you got to quit showing up smelling like liquor. At least get rid, you know, put some lotion on or some something so you don't smell so bad. But you know, I unfortunately didn't take those hints. I also, while I was in Japan, this is when I started to expand into other substance, and I won't go into great detail, but I was smoking a lot of those left-handed cigarettes, and we were doing some other kind of chemical stuff. And somebody turned us in, so I got discharged from the Air Force. I was fortunate to get an honorable discharge first for doing drugs. And when I came home, they had a little thing on my DD-219 that if you knew the code, you could tell it. I was released because of drugs, but they never did that. So anyway, I got out. I spent 3 years and 7 days in the Air Force. I got out, I came home, I had some money. I thought, well, you know, I deserve to have a good time. So I wasn't going to go to work right away. So I didn't go to work for 3 months. And till my money ran out, and it didn't go quite as far in the States as it went in Japan. I wasn't a very good employee. I had 15 jobs the first year I was out of the Air Force. I already told you I didn't work for 3 months. And the longest one I had, job I had, was for 3 months also. So that gives me 6 months of, you know, if I woke up drunk, I just roll back over and screw the job. And that carried on to the second and third year. I became a day laborer, because if you show up, great. If you don't, they just get somebody else to show up. And I had, you know, no responsibilities, and I was just, my drinking got really, really out of control. I was drinking probably 7 days a week. I can't say all the time, but I was drinking and doing those other substances. And I just, I saw nothing wrong with it. You know, I knew that was my lot in life, to be an alcoholic and die. And there used to be a show on TV on Saturday night called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they, this was before they had the little digital things, and they would sit you behind this black screen and put a light behind you, and you would see the silhouette. It used to come on at 1 o'clock. That'd be about the time when I was really peaking. And I go, I'm going to be on there one day. And I was on there 4 times, but that's the longest running show in Time Warner. It was on for 41 years. So I was drinking. I got a home. I bought a home. My sister moved in. My youngest sister moved in with me. She was, like I said, she was involved in doing a lot of other substance besides drinking. I got involved in that considerably more, and I started to do things that I really didn't like. I rented out my closet to this guy for $100 for the month so he could leave 3 guns in there. You know, I had no idea what the hell he'd use them guns for. Could have been anything. If something would have happened and they found them in my house, it would have probably been me. I'm so fortunate that I didn't go to jail or prison. I wrecked over 20 cars. That's the closest I can come. At one time, if they lasted more than 6 months, that was a miracle. And I had 6 DWIs, only one conviction, because after the first one, I knew how to handle the system. Just get a lawyer and they'll work it out for you. So I kept going. I kept thinking I needed to do something about my drinking. The drugs scared me more than the drinking, because I'd always drank, and I figured if I could just quit the drugs, then I could just drink somewhat normal again. But that's not the way it was. This same sister that was living with me, her boyfriend went to Serenity Lodge, and that was a treatment facility that used to be out in Chesapeake. And I thought, well, you know, this guy's really hosed up. If he can go, I can do it too. What I didn't find out till after I got out, he went in there because the cops were looking for him. And if you're under medical treatment, they come to the place, they're not going to say whether you're there or not. So, but anyway, I went to this treatment facility, and I spent 28 days there, which was the usual at the time. And I had a good insurance, and they paid all of it but $2,000. And I got out, and I started hanging around with the guys and gals that I had met there. I got a sponsor, and I got a home group, and I was doing all them things. Am I running too long? I've seen you look at your watch. I need to speed it up anyway. I'm still in my drunk-a-log. I just needed to change things. So I stayed dry 7.5 months. And towards the end of it, the only reason I lasted that long, I told myself I would outlast the other people that I was in treatment with, and I was the last one that I knew of that was still sober. So I went back out drinking. And here's how foolish I was. I thought I could turn it on and cut it off like a tap. And I was working in South Carolina when I went back to drinking. They sent me back to Norfolk. And I was on a van with the guy coming back, and I'm thinking, well, I'll just go to my home group was the baby group on Saturday night. I thought, I'll just go to my home group, pick up a white chip, and everything will be okay. But when I got home, I never made it to the meeting that night. I was drinking and doing some other stuff with this guy that was living with me. I bounced around in AA for about 7.5 months, and I finally hit a bottom. I was out drinking. I went out. I had been dressed to go to my home group Saturday night. I went across the street to talk to my roommate, and somebody said, "You want a beer?" And I said, "No." And the next thing I knew, I was drinking a beer. And they went going to the meeting that night, and I was talking to another neighbor, and he wanted to go out and hit some bars, so I said, sure. So we went out and went up one side of Ocean View Avenue and down, back down the other side, and then came back up to 4th View Street. And there's not that many bars down there now, but at that time there was quite a few. And it took us like a day and a quarter to get them all. I woke up drunk in some place. I had no idea where the hell I was, and there was beer bottles and half-empty beer bottles sitting around. And I got home, and I just knew I didn't have to live like that. And I went upstairs to my bedroom, and I had the first sincere prayer of my life. I said, "Help me." And I was honest about it. Before, I used to make them deals, if you get me out of this one, I'll never do it again, and, you know. And as soon as I was out of trouble, I was doing it again. I called the hotline, and they talked. It was too late to go to a meeting that night. And so they asked me if I could not drink till tomorrow, the next day, and go to a meeting, and I did. And I knew enough people then, and I went to a meeting where I knew there would be enough of them, and I took one of the longest walks I took in a long time is to get up and pick up that white chip again, because I had picked up, I don't know, maybe 8, 9 in that six weeks that I've been bouncing in and out of AA. So like I said, I got another sponsor. I knew him. We started talking and hanging out together, and in the mid-80s, there was no real sitting down with anybody and reading the big book line by line. They told you, if read it if you want to, if you don't, that's okay too. And so I would carry a big book with me, and if I got a chance during the day, got a break, I would try and read some of it. And so I didn't get in the big book. We were more about working on the steps and doing them. And I had some issues with doing my fourth step. I procrastinated a very long time. I wouldn't recommend it because it had to do with something that I couldn't share with anybody. And finally, I was working with a counselor, and we kept digging and digging, and we got to it. And he pulled it out of me. I told my two closest friends in AA at that time about it, and I told my sponsor. And if I'm working with another man and something pertains to this issue comes up, I'll share it with them. I won't share it in an open meeting because we share our experience, strength, and hope in a general way. And so I started to get more involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, I had the same home group, the baby group, on Saturday night. A gentleman named Bill Ackerman and myself started opening up, and we rotated weeks, so we didn't have to be there early each time. So I did it for 2 years, and then I got a little bit burned out on it, so I put the keys down. But I became the GSR, and with the pamphlet, the old GSR pamphlet used to say, it might be the most important job in AA. And if your group doesn't have a GSR, I recommend you get some because you're out of contact with AA as a whole. The reason I went, because I thought assemblies were like the Oceanfront Conference. I'd just been at the Oceanfront Fun and Games, you know. And I got elected, and I went the next week, and I didn't know anybody there, and I didn't have a clue of what the hell was going on. And But I bounced around that weekend. And I started to see a part of AA that I hadn't seen before. Before, AA had all been focused on me. And I just, I started to see stuff about AA that I didn't recognize. Excuse me again, that cotton mouth. See, half the time I don't wear my false teeth. And since I was speaking, I figured I'd better have them in so it won't look so bad, you know. See, there was a time I couldn't say that about myself because I would get humiliated, but I can laugh at it because I know it's just one of my little quirks. One time I lost them for a week, so I have a bad habit of misplacing or losing, I don't know what you want to call it, things. But anyway, so I'm getting sober, and I go to this assembly, and I meet some new people, and I come home, and I got to go to this thing once a month and come back and give a report, and nobody wants to hear the report, and I'm getting a little bit of a resentment because, you know, I spent all this time getting this information, the same thing with the assemblies, and they said, just vote however you want, but I would try to do the best I can. I started making friends. When I first came to AA, I had a very, very difficult time making friends. And I got hooked up with these two guys, and if one of us turned a corner, the other two were usually right behind. And we did that for about a year. Like I said, June 1st of 86, my sister passed away. That was 17 days before my first anniversary, and I got a call. I went down to the hospital, and they asked me to go in this room, and I've been to many emergency rooms, and they've never told me to go to a room. They always said, just sit out there, we'll get to you when you can, so I knew I was a little worried. A doctor and a nurse came in, talked to me, and they went back. Somebody came and got them. They come back out. And they informed me that my sister had passed, and then I still hadn't made a visual identification of her, so I went in hoping, maybe it's not her, but it was her. And I thought things couldn't get no worse than that. Then I had to notify my parents and my sisters. And I was thinking, still, that things can't get any worse than this. My father was sickly and my mother was unable to do it, so I had to make the arrangements for the services. And that's something I don't wish on anybody, but it's stuff that's got to be done. And in a couple weeks it'll be June 1st again. And I used to always in May start thinking about my sister's death. Maybe 10 years or so ago, I don't really think about it. And then one year, I didn't think about it till June 2nd. And I was just odd. If you stay around here long enough, time will heal your deepest sorrows. So anyway, I got involved. I became the DCM. I found out in AA, if you say yes, they'll let you do any job. And they let me keep doing them. I was the DCM, then I was a grapevine and literature guy, then I was the alternate delegate, and then I got to be the delegate for the Virginia area. And that was a mind-blowing thing, because here was a drunk from Ocean View, a high school dropout drunk from Ocean View that didn't have a whole lot of self-esteem then. I had some then, but not a whole lot. Going with these people that were lawyers, doctors, and Indian chiefs. And I fit in. I was just another drunk. I couldn't talk as well as some of them. I remember towards the end of the first conference, somebody came down to me and said, you just have a way of making it simple and easier to understand. And I felt really good about that. It was 1995 and 96 when I was a delegate, so it's been quite a while. The first delegate that I really knew as a standing delegate was a guy named Tom Hearns, and Steve knows about him. And he was the granddaddy of AA and Weston Tidewater. But I kept doing things. While I was doing, I had issues touching and hugging people. So I decided that I would go to massage school, because what better way to do that than you got to put your hands on all these people. So I went to massage school while I was working a full-time job and working all these service positions in AA. And when I got done with that, I found out I spent about $2,500 to learn how to hug, and I could have just come to the damn meeting and told people hug me, and it would have saved me all that money. But you know, some of us have to go follow a strange path. I went back to school a couple times. I got some classes. I did some when I was towards the end of my drinking. I did most of it when I was out of school. You know, I keep thinking I want to go back again, because if you're over 65, you can go to the Tidewater Community College for free. You just audit the classes. You don't get no grade or anything, but, you know, there's a couple classes I keep saying I'm going to audit, but I never get around to doing it, so. You know, my life is pretty full for being retired. I retired about 2015, I think it was, or semi-retired. I've been in the building 6 years, so. Yeah, about 8 or 9 years, maybe, and I have a love for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very involved in the Archives Committee. And I'm digitally putting all our information into electronic so we can transfer it digitally. And, you know, some days I work on it for 4, 5, 6 hours. Other days I work an hour and I say, oh, forget it. And the bad thing about that is, I've got a couple of those things, that channels that you zoom, and they have all these things, and I wind up watching seven episodes, and then it's time to go to a meeting. But, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that's ever happened to me. I've had so many positive experiences. I was baptized a Catholic and confirmed an Episcopalian. And after many years, I found out why I had to get confirmed. My mother had an affair, and she felt guilty, so she wanted me to get confirmed and take care of the load, you know. So, but that was one of the better things that happened to me. I went back to church in about 2000, and I got hooked up with this crowd of 5 or 6 people that, a couple of them looked like they might need our fellowship, but they didn't drink like the way I did. They were able to stop. And I became friends with these people, and I got involved in with the church. And I just was looking at all the past ministers out there. And the minister from the time I was at Advent Church in Norfolk is up there on the wall. And of course, they don't have no dates or his name on there, so I can't figure that out yet. But anyway, he was a user, and just because he's a head of he's a priest doesn't mean he can't be a user. The same thing with, there's a lot of users in AA that will turn you out and turn you in. And again, I don't know what time it is. Oh shit. It's still got 20 minutes, 10, 15 minutes. Okay. I agreed to come up here and speak. And I was supposed to speak next week. And God changed his mind and put me up here this week. I'm a basketball fan. And I'm a Celtics fan. I got my Celtics socks on because it wouldn't be appropriate to wear a Celtic shirt when I'm speaking. But they're on, and, you know, I was over there watching it. And there was a time where my whole life balanced on how the Celtics did. In the drinking days, if they lost, that was a good excuse to go on a bender. If they won was a good excuse to go on a bending, you know. Everything was a good excuse. But I've been following them since 1965. And I can't believe, except for the 2 years I was overseas, I pretty much followed basketball pretty close. We used to play kids. I was a short little chubby kid, and I would be the last one to get picked. So when we played basketball, my job was to hack them, you know, make sure they didn't get a good shot off. So I didn't do well with that. I played baseball 1 year, and I don't know why I didn't go back the second year. Probably because my parents were fighting again, and there was no way to get there. You know, I look at my life today, and I think, wow, I've never had it this good. I know people from all over Virginia and the United States and the world. I just left a Zoom meeting that was hosted in London, and there were people there. There was about a half a dozen people there that I knew that if I saw them somewhere, I could say hi and have a conversation, and we'd have something in common. And like I said, I'm a history buff. Not only do I follow AA history, I love our history of America. You know, more battles were fought in the Civil War in Virginia than any other place in the United States. And I digress to other things. But I just, I don't know. For some reason, I seem to be hitting a wall. Usually, I can just go right through. I'm having some issues, medical issues, and that can be part of it. I lost 60-some pounds a couple of years ago, and I've slowly started to gain it back again. And it's because I'm eating too much and I'm eating the wrong things. I'm a diabetic. I came off insulin. I came off pretty much almost all my diabetic medicine. They put me back on the pills, and then just this week they put me back on insulin. And I knew it was going to happen because I'm not taking care of myself. You know, when you get sober, after a while, other things start to affect you. I'll be 73 in September, and my body is not doing as well as once did. I'm having some issues with my memory, and that kind of gets frustrating when I go to a history meeting and I make a comment, and then one of the other guys I know that's a history buff says, "Well, Bob, you sure you meant that?" I go, "Well, I don't know. Tell me if it was right or not." But again, you know, I'm not worried about those things. I try to do the best I can. God has put me here for a reason. I haven't been sponsoring a lot of men lately. I think I have 3 guys I sponsor now. And they've all got long-term sobriety, which is fine with me. There's a lot of new guys out there that can sponsor other guys. I don't have a car, which is a first in a very long time, except for when I was... Damn, this thing's trying to kill me. Except for when I was drinking and I would wreck my cars. But people have been great. I've asked for help and they've responded. And they, you know, the same thing would have been with the people from church. But nowhere else I don't think that you can get that people will come out of their way, pick you up and give you a ride. And for about 8 months, Colin used to give me a ride home to my sister's house when I was staying with her, and we would get to chat, and I get to know her a little bit better, and hopefully she got to know me a little bit better. Same thing with Shannon. I had seen her around for a while, but I didn't know her, and now that we're part of the same home group and I've been riding with her, I've been getting to talk to her a little bit. I didn't really know her husband, Russell, till a few months ago when I started talking to him, or he started talking to me. I can't remember which it was, and it really doesn't matter. And then there's this new guy that I wish I could remember his name.
Jeff.
You know. Sometimes I wish I could remember my name, but that's another story. But, you know, stick around. You know, you new guy, stick around. Get some phone numbers. It's hard as hell to call at first. But when your butt's falling off, you'll start dialing them numbers. Like when my sister passed, I had 10 numbers that I was going to be calling regular that I had. I called all 10 of them that morning. And this was before cell phones. And I got like nine answer machines and one just rung. And, you know, I don't want to be like that today. I know today I got a buddy up in Petersburg. I can call him up any time of the day and the night and talk to him. Same thing with my buddy Charlie in Northern Virginia. I feel very fortunate that these people consider me their friend. You know, before I started drinking, I wasn't your friend. The only thing I was somebody what I could get out of you. And that's not the case today. So I don't know what time it is, but it's getting close enough. So I'd like to thank you for having me here, and I hope somebody got something out of my rambling.